Hello, my name is Greg, and I'm a reader with the Talking Information Center. For the next hour, I will be reading some news articles from the AP Network Newswire for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. So we are already into April. Easter weekend was last weekend. March Madness is over for both the men's and women's titles, and there's a lot going on in the world. We'll start our reading and see how many articles we can cover over the next hour. The headline of the first article we'll read is Trump warns a whole civilization will die tonight if a deal with Iran isn't reached. Airstrikes hit two bridges and a train station in Iran on Tuesday, and Iranian officials urged young people to form human chains to protect power plants, as U.S. President Donald Trump warned that a whole civilization will die tonight if Tehran does not meet his latest deadline for the Islamic Republic to agree to a deal that includes reopening the crucial Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. also struck military targets on the Iranian oil hub of Karg Island, according to a White House official who was not authorized to speak publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. The attack marked the second time the island was targeted. Earlier in the war, American forces struck air defenses, a radar site, an airport, and an hovercraft base there, according to satellite analysis by the Institute for the Study of War and the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project. Trump has extended previous deadlines, but suggested the one he set for 8 p.m. in Washington was final, and the rhetoric on both sides reached a fever pitch, leaving Iranians on edge. Trump threatened to destroy all of Iran's power plants and bridges if Tehran does not allow traffic to fully resume in the strait, through which a fifth of the world's oil transits in peacetime. Iran's president said 14 million people, including himself, have volunteered to fight. It was not clear if the latest airstrikes were linked to Trump's threats to attack bridges. At least two of the targets were connected to Iran's rail network, which Israel earlier signaled it might attack. Israel has increasingly carried out strikes that it says are aimed at delivering a blow to Iran's economy. Iran, meanwhile, fired on Israel and Saudi Arabia, prompting the temporary closure of a major bridge. While Iran cannot match the sophistication of U.S. and Israeli weaponry or their dominance in the air, its chokehold on the strait is causing major damage to the world economy and raising the pressure on Trump, both at home and abroad, to find a way out of the standoff. Officials involved in diplomatic efforts said talks were ongoing, but Iran has rejected the latest American proposal, and it was unclear if a deal would come in time to head off Trump's threatened attacks. World leaders and experts warned that strikes as destructive as Trump threatened could constitute a war crime. A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, if a deal isn't reached, Trump said in a post Tuesday morning, while keeping open the possibility of an off-ramp, saying that maybe something revolutionary, wonderful, can happen. Earlier, Iranian official Alireza Rahimi issued a video message calling on all young people, athletes, artists, students, and university students, and their professors to form human chains around power plants. Iranians have formed human chains in the past around nuclear sites at times of heightened tensions with the West. This time, though, it was unclear who would heed the call, and one major power plant in Tehran apparently has been closed off for security purposes at the time the demonstration was to start. President Masoud Pezeshkian posted on X that 14 million Iranians had answered state media and text message campaigns urging people to volunteer to fight, and said he would join them, while a general from the paramilitary Revolutionary Guards urged parents to send their children to man the checkpoints. The guard, meanwhile, warned that Iran would deprive the U.S. and its allies of the region's oil and gas for years and expand its attacks across the Gulf region if Trump carries out his threat. In Tehran, the mood was bleak. A young teacher said that many opponents of Iran's Islamic system had hoped Trump's attacks would quickly topple it. Now, as the war drags on, she fears U.S. and Israeli attacks will spread chaos. If we don't have the internet, if we don't have electricity, water, and gas, we are really going back to the Stone Age, as Trump said, she told the Associated Press. French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot joined a growing chorus of international voices calling for restraint, saying attacks targeting civilian and energy infrastructure are barred by the rules of war and international law. They would, without doubt, trigger a new phase of escalation of reprisals that could drag the region and the world economy into a vicious circle, the minister said on France Info Television. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also warned the U.S. that attacks on civilian infrastructure are banned under international law, according to his spokesperson. Such cases are notoriously difficult to prosecute, and Trump told reporters he's not at all concerned about committing war crimes. A series of intense airstrikes pounded Iran, including in residential neighborhoods. Tehran pounded Tehran, including in residential neighborhoods. Such strikes in the past have targeted Iranian government and security officials. Israel's military said it attacked an Iranian petrochemical site in Shiraz. The second day in a row it hit such a facility. Israel also issued a Farsi language warning, telling Iranians to avoid trains throughout the day, likely telegraphing intended strikes on the rail network. Iranian officials said later that a railway bridge, a train station, and a highway bridge had been hit in airstrikes. Neither the United States nor Israel immediately claimed the attacks. Another strike hit the Karamabad International Airport in western Iran, and an attack on an unidentified target in Alborz province, northwest of Tehran, killed 18 people, according to state media. A total of 15 people were killed in other strikes, Iranian media reported. Early Tuesday, Tehran launched seven ballistic missiles at Saudi Arabia, which authorities said rained debris near energy facilities as they were intercepted. The attacks prompted Saudi Arabia to temporarily close the King Fahd Causeway, the only road connection between Bahrain, home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, and the Arabian Peninsula. Iran also fired on Israel with reports of incoming missiles in Tel Aviv and Eilat. More than 1,900 people have been killed in Iran since the war began, but the government has not updated that toll for days. In Lebanon, where Israel is fighting Iran-backed Hezbollah militants, more than 1,400 people have been killed and more than 1 million people have been displaced. 11 Israeli soldiers have died there. In Gulf Arab states and the occupied West Bank, more than 24 people have died, while 23 have been reported dead in Israel and 13 U.S. service members have been killed. Iran choked off shipping through the Strait of Hormuz after Israel and the U.S. attacked on February 28th, starting the war. That stranglehold and Iran's attacks on the energy infrastructure of its Gulf Arab neighbors have sent oil prices skyrocketing, raising the price of oil, gasoline, food, and other basics far beyond the Middle East. In spot trading on Tuesday, the Brent crude, the international standard, was above $108 per barrel, up about 50% since the war started. On Monday, Tehran rejected a 45-day ceasefire proposal and said it wants a permanent end to the war. But as Trump's deadline neared Tuesday, an official said indirect communications between the United States and Iran remained underway. The official said mediators from Pakistan, Egypt, and Turkey are racing against time to reach a compromise before the deadline. He said Iran has linked the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz to sanctions relief, and the U.S. was open to easing some sanctions, especially on Iran's oil sector, in part to stabilize the global oil market. So that is a little update on what is happening in Iran, as the president has issued a deadline for 8 p.m. tonight, Washington time. And it will be interesting to see if no deal is reached before then, what the actions are of the U.S. and Israel. This is another story that is ongoing. Headline reads, gunmen attack a building housing the Israeli consulate in Istanbul. Three assailants opened fire at police outside a building housing the Israeli consulate in Istanbul on Tuesday, sparking a gunfight that left one attacker dead, Turkish officials said. The two other assailants were wounded and captured. Two police officers sustained light injuries in the crash. Istanbul Governor Davut Gül told reporters the assailants were carrying long-barreled weapons. Interior Minister Mustafa Safidi wrote on X that the attackers had traveled from the city of İzmit, some 60 miles east of Istanbul, in a rented car. One of the assailants was linked to a group he described as exploiting religion without naming the organization. The Islamic State group has carried out deadly attacks in Turkey in the past. The two wounded assailants are brothers, identified as Onur C. and Enes C. The first has a criminal record related to drugs. Both are being interrogated, according to the Interior Ministry. Video from the attack showed one assailant carrying what appeared to be an assault rifle, wearing a brown backpack and hiding behind a bus when exchanging fire with police. A police officer falls to the ground, apparently having been shot, and then rolls away to get behind a tree for cover. One of the police officers was wounded in the leg and the other in the ear, the Interior Ministry said. The consulate is located in a high-rise building in Levent, one of the city's main business districts. Officials said there are no Israeli diplomats present in Israel missions in Turkey. Israel withdrew its diplomats amid security concerns and deteriorating relations with Turkey during the war in Gaza. Turkish Justice Minister Akin Gürlük said three prosecutors, including a deputy chief prosecutor, have been signed to lead an investigation. Police sealed off the building and blocked several roads, while forensic experts in white protective suits combed the area for evidence. Turkish President Recep Erdogan denounced what he said was a treacherous attack. "We will resolutely continue our fight against all forms of terrorism, and we will not allow the climate of security in Turkey to be harmed by vile and timed provocations like today's," he said. U.S. Ambassador to Turkey Tom Barrack condemned the assault, praising Turkish authorities for their swift and decisive response. Israel's foreign ministry similarly condemned the attack and commended Turkish security forces for their rapid action in thwarting it. So that is kind of an update on an attack that occurred just this morning. We'll take a look at the space mission that is ongoing now. Article about it. The headline reads, Artemis II breaks the Apollo 13's distance record with a daring moon flyby that included a solar eclipse. After traveling deeper into space than any other humans, the Artemis II astronauts pointed their moonship toward home on Monday night, wrapping up a lunar cruise that revealed views of the far side never beheld by eyes until now. Their flyby of the moon, NASA's first return since the Apollo era, even included some celestial sightseeing besides yielding rich science. It was a significant step toward landing boot prints near the moon's south pole in just 2 years. A total solar eclipse greeted the three Americans and one Canadian as the moon temporarily blocked the sun from their perspective. Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Saturn nodded at them from the black void. The landing sites of Apollo... got an ad broken. Look. Oh, my gosh. Okay, let's try that again. The landing sites of Apollo 12 and 14 were also visible, poignant reminders of NASA's first age of exploration after more than half a century. In an especially riveting retro throwback, Artemis II shattered the distance record set by Apollo 13 in 1970. NASA's Orion capsule reached a maximum distance of 252,756 miles from Earth before hanging a U-turn behind the moon 4,101 miles farther than Apollo 13. It is blowing my mind what you can see with the naked eye from the moon right now. It is just unbelievable, Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen radioed. He challenged this generation and the next to make sure this record is not long-lived. Apollo 13 commander James Lovell wished the crew well in a recording made 2 months before his death last August. Mission Control beamed up his message to Commander Reid Wiseman, pilot Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Hansen before their flyby began. Welcome to my old neighborhood, said Lovell, who also flew on Apollo 8, humanity's first lunar visit. It's a historic day, and I know how busy you will be, but don't forget to enjoy the view. The Artemis II astronauts carried up with them the Apollo 8 silk patch that accompanied Lovell to the moon. It's just a real honor to have that on board with us, Wiseman said. Artemis II is using the same maneuver that Apollo 13 did. Excuse me. After its Houston, we have a problem. Oxygen tank explosion wiped out any hope of a moon landing. Known as a free return lunar trajectory, this no stopping to land route takes advantage of the Earth's and moon's gravity, reducing the need for fuel. It is a celestial figure eight that put the astronauts on course for home once they emerged from behind the moon on Monday evening. Artemis II's lunar fly-around and intense observation period lasted 7 hours, by far the highlight of the nearly 10-day test flight that will end with a splashdown in the Pacific on Friday. Venturing as close as 4,067 miles to the gray, dusty surface, the astronauts zipped through a list of more than two dozen targets using powerful Nikon cameras as well as their iPhones to zoom in on impact craters and other intriguing lunar features. Before getting started, they requested permission to name two bright, freshly carved craters. They suggested Integrity, the name of their capsule, and Carol, Commander Wiseman's wife, who died of cancer in 2020. Wiseman wept as Hansen put in the request to Mission Control, and all four astronauts embraced in tears. Such a majestic view out here, Wiseman radioed once he regained his composure and started picture-taking. The astronauts called down that they had managed to capture the moon and Earth in the same shot, and they provided a running commentary to scientists back in Houston on what they were seeing. At one point, Koch reported an overwhelming sensation of emotion for a second or two while zooming in on the moon. Something just drew me in suddenly to the lunar landscape, and it became real, she said. The Artemis II astronauts made their closest approach to the moon and reached their maximum distance from Earth while they were out of contact. Their speed at the closest approach, 3,139 miles per hour. The spacecraft accelerated as it appeared from behind the moon and the planned communications blackout and made tracks for Earth. As Earthrise came into view, showing Asia, Africa, and Oceania, as Mission Control called out, we are earthbound and ready to bring you home. Flight controllers in Houston flipped their mission patches over to signify the return leg. President Donald Trump phoned the astronauts following the flyby, calling them modern-day pioneers. Today you've made history and made all America really proud, incredibly proud, the president said, adding that more lunar traveling is coming and ultimately the whole big trip to Mars. Wiseman and his crew spent years studying lunar geography to prepare for the big event, adding solar eclipses to their repertoire during the past few weeks. By launching last Wednesday, they ensured themselves of a total solar eclipse from their vantage point behind the moon, courtesy of the cosmos. While Artemis II may be taking Apollo 13's path, it's most reminiscent of Apollo 8 and humanity's first lunar visitors who orbited the moon on Christmas Eve 1968 and read from the Book of Genesis. Glover said flying to the moon during Christianity's Holy Week brought home for him the beauty of creation. Earth is an oasis amid a whole bunch of nothing, this thing we call the universe, where humanity exists as one, he observed over the weekend. This is an opportunity for us to remember where we are, who we are, and that we are the same thing, and that we've got to get through this together, Glover said, clasping his hands with his crewmates. So quite a successful day for the NASA mission, 10-day mission that will end on Friday, but they have gone where no man has ever gone, literally. All right, we'll take a look at some other articles in the news. This article has to do with a trip by Vice President J.D. Vance to Hungary. The headline reads, Vance arrives in Hungary hoping to boost Orbán's election campaign. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance arrived in Hungary on Tuesday in a bid to turn the tide of an election campaign where long-serving Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, a close ally of President Donald Trump, is trailing in the polls. Vance's two-day trip, where he is scheduled to hold an official visit with Orbán and later appear at one of his campaign rallies, offered the clearest sign yet that the Trump administration is going all in for an Orbán victory when Hungarians go to the polls on Sunday. Orbán is running for his fifth straight term as prime minister. He and his nationalist populist Fidesz party are facing their toughest race in two decades against a center-right challenger, the Tisza party, led by Peter Magyar, that could bring an end to Orbán's 16 years in power. Long accused by critics of taking over Hungary's institutions, clamping down on press freedoms, and overseeing entrenched political corruption, charges which he denies, Orbán has become an icon in the global far-right movement. Trump has repeatedly endorsed Orbán's candidacy for re-election, and many in the Make America Great Again movement approve of the Hungarian leader's opposition to immigration, curtailing of LGBTQ+ rights, and the capture of the media and academia. But with most independent polls showing a double-digit deficit for Fidesz among decided voters ahead of the April 12th vote, Orbán has sought to boost his profile by appearing publicly with his international admirers. Vance and his wife Usha were greeted at the Budapest airport on Tuesday by Hungary's Foreign Minister Peter Zajaro. The two men greeted one another warmly, and Zajaro presented Usha Vance with a bouquet of flowers. Zajaro told state media from the airport that Vance is the first U.S. vice president to visit Hungary since 1991 and the highest-ranking U.S. official in the country since 2006. Magyar, who has pledged to draw Hungary back toward its Western partners and end its drift toward Moscow, gave a pointed critique of Vance's visit in a social media post on Tuesday. No foreign country may interfere in Hungarian elections. This is our country, Magyar wrote. Hungarian history is not written in Washington, Moscow, or Brussels. It is written in Hungary's streets and squares. I respectfully ask the U.S. Vice President, who is coming to Hungary, that if he is already campaigning for Viktor Orbán, the Hungarian people should not pay the price, Magyar said. Vance's visit wasn't the first sign of U.S. support for Orbán. Hungary, which has broken with most European Union countries by refusing to assist Ukraine with financial assistance or weapons to ward off Russia's full-scale invasion, has remained firmly committed to purchasing Russian energy despite EU efforts to wean off such supplies. In November, Hungary received an exemption from U.S. sanctions on Russian oil and gas after a White House meeting between Orbán and Trump. In February, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio visited Budapest, where he enthusiastically praised Orbán and the person-to-person connection he had established with the president, telling Orbán that Trump was deeply committed to your success because your success is our success. Late last month, Orbán hosted dozens of allies from around Europe and beyond at the Hungarian iteration of the Conservative Political Action Conference, and at a meeting of the far-right Patriots for Europe party family, the third largest group in the European Parliament. Trump sent a video message to CPAC Hungary, saying Orbán had his complete and total endorsement and was a, quote, fantastic guy. The Trump administration's embrace of Orbán reflects its affinity for European far-right parties broadly, and the admiration from Spain to France to Germany and the Netherlands has been mutual. Still, Trump's recent approach to foreign affairs has reverberated in Europe, with his actions over Greenland, Venezuela, and Iran straining those relationships. Orbán, however, has remained deferential and has echoed, Orbán, however, has remained deferential and has echoed Trump's false claims that he won the 2020 election. In comments to state radio just before Trump began his second term, Orbán said Democrats took the presidency away from Donald Trump through fraud. Vance's planned appearance at Orbán's election rally was an unusual step from a foreign leader and a break with the practice of most politicians who avoid actively taking part in the political campaigns of other countries. Orbán himself has bristled at the slightest mention of the Hungarian election by other EU leaders, decrying any expressions of support for his opponent as a grave breach of Hungary's sovereignty and meddling in the election. So it'll be interesting to see the results of this particular election. On Sunday, the election is scheduled to be held. It'll be interesting to see if the current Prime Minister Orbán holds his seat for another four-year term or if he is defeated by the center-right Liberal Party. Take a look at this headline, this article, the headline which reads, "Trial is ending for a doctor accused of trying to kill his wife during a cliffside hike in Hawaii." An attempted murder trial is wrapping up for an anesthesiologist accused of trying to kill his wife during a cliffside hike near a popular scenic lookout in Hawaii, with closing arguments expected on Tuesday. The trial started last month, nearly a year after Gerhardt and Ariel Koenig went on a hike in the Pali Puka Trail in Honolulu that ended with her bloodied and screaming that he tried to kill her. Gerhardt Koenig has pleaded not guilty. The couple were on a weekend trip to Hawaii's capital city for her birthday in March of 2025, while their two young sons stayed home on Maui. Near a lookout offering sweeping views, Gerhardt Koenig, 47, upset about his wife's relationship with a coworker, tried to push her off the steep trail, bashed her head with a rock, and attempted to stab her with a syringe, prosecutors allege. The trial, with testimony live streamed by Court TV, has aired the couple's marital problems leading up to the hike, along with their versions of what happened on the trail. Gerhardt Koenig testified that his wife was having an affair, which he confirmed by unlocking her phone while she slept. The relationship, which Ariel Koenig characterized as an emotional affair involving flirty messages with a coworker, came up during the hike. Ariel Koenig testified that her husband grabbed her and moved her toward the cliff's edge, but she threw herself on the ground in an attempt to hold on. He straddled her and had a syringe in his hand, but she said, but she batted it away. She bit his forearm and squeezed his testicles in an attempt to get him off of her. Her husband denied pushing her toward the edge and testified that she hit him with a rock on the side of her face. He wrestled the rock away and hit her with it twice in self-defense. He denied having any syringes on the mountain or trying to stab her. His defense attorney told jurors no syringe was found at the scene. Two hikers who heard Ariel Koenig's screams help her get down the trail. Palipuka, which means pierced cliff in Hawaiian, leads to a hole in a rock ridge through which hikers can look out over the forest to see the ocean. The trail is closed because state officials have deemed it unsafe, but hikers often enter through a small clearing, ignoring a warning sign that reads, "Area closed, do not go beyond this sign." Gerhard Koenig testified that as he watched his wife crawl away, he believed his marriage and career were over, and he decided to jump to his death. But first, he called his adult son from a previous marriage. The son told authorities that his father said he, quote, tried to kill your stepmom, a confession that Gerhard Koenig denied having made. He spent hours on the mountain before deciding to come down and surrender to police. His wife has since filed for divorce. No big surprise there. So it'll be interesting to see what the verdict in that particular trial will be. So this is an interesting article. If you're a parent and you've ever taken your kids to the zoo, the headline reads, parents charged after toddler slips into wolf area and gets hurt at the Hershey Park Zoo. The parents of a toddler who suffered a minor injury at a Pennsylvania theme park zoo after squeezing through a fence near a wolf enclosure and making contact with one of the animals have been charged with endangering the welfare of children, police have said. Evidence showed that the parents both walked about 25 to 30 feet away from the child to a seating area with benches and appeared to be paying attention to their cell phones when they noticed what was happening Saturday at Zoo America in the Hershey Park theme park, police said in a news release. The child went through a small opening in a wooden barrier perimeter fence and entered a restricted area near the wolf exhibit, the Derry Township police said. The child reached a primary metal fence enclosure and was hurt after placing a hand through that fencing. From the injuries sustained, it appears as though one of the wolves in the enclosure instinctively and naturally grabbed onto the child's hand with its mouth. Several bystanders intervened and helped pull the child away, police said in the release. The parents of Lititz, Pennsylvania, were charged with the misdemeanor offense after an initial investigation and consultation with the Dauphin County District Attorney's Office, police said. Court records posted Monday showed that both await a preliminary hearing on April 28th. There were no attorneys listed for them. A phone number associated with one of the parents was not working on Tuesday. The zoo is part of the entertainment complex in Hershey, featuring a chocolate-themed amusement park. The zoo's website says it has three gray wolves. The zoo had said in a statement that the wolf's response is consistent with natural animal behavior and was not a sign of aggression. Our habitats are designed with multiple layers of protection, and clear signage and barriers are in place to help ensure safe viewing. Guests are expected to remain within designated areas and closely supervise children at all times, it said. Hershey Park made headlines last summer when a lost boy wandering a monorail line above a crowd was rescued by a park visitor who climbed onto a building and jumped onto the rails. The child was unharmed and was reunited with his family. So there you go. If you ever take your kid to the zoo, you best be aware of where they are and what they're doing. I'll take a look at a court ruling in Iowa. The headline of this story reads, Appeals Court Lets Iowa Enforce a Book Ban and Restrictions on LGBTQ plus Topics in K-6 Classrooms. Iowa can enforce a law that restricts teachers from talking about LGBTQ plus topics with students in kindergarten through the sixth grade, and bans some books in libraries and classrooms, an appellate court said on Monday. The decision for now vacates a lower court judge's temporary blocks on the law. The measure was first approved by Republican majorities in the Iowa House and Senate and GOP Governor Kim Reynolds in 2023, which they said reinforced age-appropriate education in kindergarten through 12th grades. It's been a back-and-forth battle in the courts in the 3 years since. Lawsuits were filed by the Iowa State Education Association, major publishing houses, and best-selling authors, as well as an LGBTQ plus advocacy organization called Iowa Safe Schools. The law was in effect for part of the 2024-25 school year until last March, when a federal judge reissued a temporary block on the book ban provision, which prohibits books containing specific sex acts from appearing in school libraries or classrooms. In a separate decision in May, U.S. District Judge Stephen Locher said Iowa could restrict mandatory instruction on gender identity and sexual orientation in schools up through the sixth grade, but could not enforce the restriction on any program or promotion, saying those terms were too broad. Iowa asked the U.S. Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn both decisions, which a three-judge panel did on Monday. The cases will continue in the district court while the law is in effect. This is a huge win for Iowa parents, Iowa's Republican Attorney General Brenna Byrd said in a statement. Parents should always know that school is a safe place for their children to learn, not be concerned that they're being indoctrinated with inappropriate sexual materials and philosophies. Iowa's measure was enacted in 2023 amid a wave of similar legislation around the country driven by Republican lawmakers to prohibit discussion of LGBTQ plus identities and restrict the use of restrooms in schools. Many of those laws prompted court challenges. The decision comes as Trump administration officials said on Monday it has terminated agreements adopted under previous administrations that upheld rights and protections for transgender students. The Iowa law states that K-12 school libraries cannot include materials with descriptions or visual depictions of six different sex acts. The state's defense argued that the law outlines the restrictions explicitly and that the state, in its mission of advancing children's education, has legitimate reason to ensure public school materials are appropriate. But the teachers' union, as well as publishers and authors, have maintained that the law is overly broad, reaching far beyond obscenity to prohibit any book with any description of a sex act for any age, their lawsuit stated. Plus, they argued libraries are places of voluntary learning, not existing exclusively to advance the school's educational mission. The appeals court sided with the state, saying the restrictions are not amorphous and the books in a school library can be considered part of the school's curriculum. For that reason, the court notes that the claims from the authors and publishers that the law infringes on First Amendment rights will likely not hold up. The ruling also said the First Amendment does not guarantee students the right to access books of their choosing at taxpayer expense. The law also prohibits any program, curriculum, test, survey, questionnaire, promotion, or instruction relating to gender identity or sexual orientation. Attorneys for the state maintained that the text as written means mandatory school curriculum. Opponents argued that the law is vague enough to limit any information accessed or activity engaged in at the school. Reading the plain language, the appeals court decision said, "We cannot say the state's assertion is wrong." Locher's decision last May had granted a partial injunction, saying the state could restrict such topics when it comes to curriculum, tests, surveys, questionnaires, or instruction, but not any program or promotion. Locher laid out specifically what that meant. Students in grades 6 and below must be allowed to join gender sexuality alliances and other student groups relating to gender identity and or sexual orientation. And the district teachers and students must be permitted to advertise those groups. In vacating Locher's partial block, the appeals court said Locher wrongly focused on the two words, program and promotion, in interpreting an expansive view of the law's scope. Because Iowa Safe Schools and the students asked the court to block the law on face value, not because of specific claims that it infringed on their rights, the appeals court said their complaint will likely fail on its merits. So, interesting court decision coming out of Iowa. It's a topic that is debated vigorously by many people throughout the country, for sure. Let's see. Take a look at what is happening, the bigger stories that's happening throughout the country. Take a look at this article. The headline reads, "The West Virginia governor vetoes help for neglected and foster kids after approving tax cuts." Governor Patrick Morrisey vetoed a handful of bills meant to help vulnerable West Virginians just days after signing a 5% reduction to their personal income tax. Between the tax cut and aligning some of the state's business taxes with cuts made by the Trump administration, the state will be foregoing $230 million in revenue annually. But the governor balked at the expense of providing help for foster children aging out of the system, home blood pressure monitoring to Medicaid patients, or research into new drug treatment options. In all, he vetoed a dozen bills. Both the bill to help foster kids transition out of care and another vetoed bill focused on preventing them from ending up there would likely have saved the state money in the long run. The foster care transition bill, which passed both the House and the Senate with nearly unanimous approval, would have expanded a statewide pilot program that offers former foster kids help with independent living, finding work, or enrolling in higher education. A Mountain State Spotlight investigation published last year found the state was failing to spend federal money meant to help former foster kids, and many were unaware of the independent living services the state provides. Morrisey's Department of Human Services estimated the bill would cost about $11 million when fully implemented. Morrisey wrote in his veto letter that the bill contains uncontrollable cost drivers. The problem is that the bill requires the Department of Human Services to expand services that are already being offered through its independent living and transitional living programs, and this expansion would cost at least $5 million in the first year, he wrote. As bill sponsor Del Adam Berkhammer pointed out during a February committee meeting, not providing these kids with support now will likely mean more expensive problems in the future. If we're not going to support housing them here, there's a high probability we're going to be housing them in one of our jails or prisons, he said. While he didn't cite cost as a reason, Morrisey also vetoed a bill aimed at preventing kids from entering foster care in the first place. An economic need does not translate to abuse and neglect, and it is disconcerting to see that kind of linkage here. The insertion of the state into the family should only occur when children are truly at risk, he wrote. But research does show that impoverished families are more likely to have their kids removed because poverty is often misperceived as neglect. That's why researchers often advocate for measures that raise families out of poverty as a way to help overall child welfare. I think anti-poverty policy is child protection policy, UCal Irvine sociology professor Kelly Fong told the Mountain State Spotlight earlier this year. Every year, more than 1,000 West Virginia kids are removed from their parents solely because of neglect. According to federal data, another 200 are removed only because of inadequate housing. The governor also vetoed legislation that mandated the release of funds collected by the state's medical marijuana program, $5 million of which would have funded a commission to help with thousands of child abuse and neglect court cases. Morrisey's office said that his administration is trying to both meet the needs of vulnerable populations and cut taxes. He said several vetoes were because cost of the programs were open-ended or lacked a clear focus. Families are dealing with higher costs across the board, and letting them keep more of what they earn is one of the most direct ways we can help, spokesman Lars Daleside said in an email. The West Virginia Center on Budget Policy estimates 80% of the state's population will receive between $4 and $145 a year from the income tax cut. And while aligning the state's taxes with federal taxes would increase the child tax care credits, it's mostly businesses that are seeing the relief. So there you go. That's a story from West Virginia. which interestingly cut taxes and cut welfare programs. So it's an interesting choice that the governor there has made. Let's see, we'll take a look at some stories around the region. It's an interesting story about tailors. Not so sure that many of us use tailors anymore. And the headline reads, "Tailors age out of the workforce even as demand for their skill grows." Hunched over a sewing machine, Kill Bay is hemming a dress inside his Manhattan tailor shop when a new customer stops by with a vintage Tommy Hilfiger jacket he wants taken in. The modeling agent paid $20 at a thrift store for his reversible bomber style that's plaid on one side and red on the other. He's willing to spend $280 to have it slimmed down. Alteration requests with such a price disparity would have seemed odd a few years ago, the tailor says, but are helping to keep the bobbins bobbing at his one-man shop, 85 Custom Tailor. Bay carefully examines the cotton jacket before moving in to pin it, circling the customer like a sculptor with a chisel. He started training as a tailor at age 17 in his native South Korea. Now 63 years old, he's part of a shrinking breed in the U.S., where professional sewers, dressmakers, and tailors are aging out of the workforce as their services find fresh demand. Shoppers who grew up on disposable fast fashion are enlisting tailors and seamstresses to give off-the-rack purchases a custom fit or personal flair, to revive secondhand finds, or to extend the lives of their wardrobes, according to fashion industry experts. Weight loss drugs like Zepbound and Wegovy mean more Americans are seeking adjusted waistbands, tapered sleeves, and other types of resizing. "I recommend this job to young people because this one cannot be AI'd," Bay said, noting artificial intelligence is automating pattern making, but so far cannot replicate a tailor's handiwork. "Different bodies, different shapes, they cannot copy like this. If I close this door, I can go out and find another one." But like engraving, repairing musical instruments and many other skilled trades, creating and fitting garments to individual specifications hasn't attracted enough entry-level workers over the years to replace the professionals retiring their pincushions after decades of performing their craft. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimated almost 2 years ago there were fewer than 17,000 tailors, custom sewers, and dressmakers working in business establishments nationwide, a 30% decline from a decade earlier. Including self-employed individuals and people working in private households, the median age for all sewers, dressmakers, and tailors was 54 years old last year, 12 years older than the median for the entire employed population, according to the Bureau. The income that a proficiency with needle and thread commands relative to the skills needed and the physical toll of bending over detailed work for hours likely discourages teenagers and young adults from heeding Bay's advice, fashion industry experts said. The mean annual wage that tailors, dressmakers, and custom sewers earned as of May 2024 was $44,000 a year compared to $68,000 for all workers, according to BLS calculations. Most of fashion training is really aimed at mass production, not spending time in a shop hand-making a garment, said Scott Carnes, the provost of LIM College, a for-profit college that offers degrees and disciplines from the business side of fashion. The work is also tedious. Online job postings for tailors, dressmakers, and sewers have remained fairly stable, according to Corey Stahl, an economist with the research arm of job site Indeed. Between February 2020 and the end of the same month this year, advertised openings decreased by roughly 2%, while postings for both marketing and software jobs declined by nearly 30%. "There is a kind of craftsmanship that I think is an important piece that we can't ignore," Stahl, who focuses on U.S. labor market, said. Oh, interesting. Not many young people going into tailoring. And I guess that's not a surprise. It is not especially well paid and certainly is hard work when you look at what is required of the people in that profession. let's see. We'll take a look at a story of Savannah Guthrie returning to the Today Show for the first time since her mother was declared missing, kidnapped. The headline reads, Savannah Guthrie returns to Today anchor desk for the first time since her mother's disappearance. Savannah Guthrie was back in almost all business at NBC's Today Show anchor desk on Monday, marking a return for the first time in more than 2 months since her mother's disappearance. Here we go, ready or not, Guthrie said as the show opened. Let's do the news. After running through a series of news headlines, Guthrie said that we are so glad that you started our week with us, and it's good to be back home. Her co-host Craig Melvin said that it's good to have you back at home. She greeted longtime co-worker Al Roker with Good Morning Sunshine when he noted that it was good to see her on the set. At the end of the first 25-minute portion of the show, she offered Melvin a high five. Emotions got the better of her before the last half hour when she joined her colleagues in front of fans gathered at the show's Rockefeller Center studio. She fought back tears when one fan was seen with a Welcome Home Savannah shirt and clutched colleague Jenna Bush Hager's arm and thanked people for their support. Guthrie, one of morning television's most recognizable faces, has been a Today Show host since 2012. She has acknowledged that she's a changed person and that it is hard to go forward not knowing what happened to Nancy Guthrie, who authorities believe was taken against her will from her Arizona home. Despite an intense search involving thousands of federal and local officers and volunteers, there has been no sign of the 84-year-old mother of three said she was reported missing on February 1st. The Today Show has followed the story closely for the past 2 months, but it wasn't mentioned during the first hour of her return on Monday. Bringing things back to normal was clearly intentional. An ad popped up and stays there, and it's hard to get rid of it. Her return wasn't referenced during interviews with NBC's Gabe Gutierrez at the White House and military analyst Steve Warren on the Today Show set. Hoda Kotb, the former anchor who had filled in for Guthrie for much of the past 2 months and interviewed her former colleague, wasn't on the set on Monday. Today has seen a ratings boost over the past 2 months and has even eclipsed ABC's Good Morning America as the leader in the morning's show ratings. These shows aren't the profit generators they once were for the networks, but the rivalry is still intense. Today averaged 3.1 million viewers for the first 3 months of the year, up nearly 9% in an era most broadcast programs lose viewers. It's hard to tell how much the Guthrie story had to do with that. NBC also aired the Super Bowl and the Winter Olympics in February, and both events tend to help a morning show's ratings. Good Morning America averaged 2.9 million viewers, up 2% over 2025, while CBS Morning plunged 17% to 1.8 million viewers, according to the Nielsen Company. As part of a video message released by her New York church on Easter Sunday, Guthrie spoke about feeling, quote, moments of deep disappointment with God, the feeling of utter abandonment. But she said the resurrection is not fully celebrated if we do not acknowledge the feelings of loss, pain, and yes, even death. In announcing her return to the NBC flagship morning show, Guthrie said she was uncertain whether she'll feel like she still belongs. It's hard to imagine doing it because it's such a place of joy and lightness, she said just over a week ago on Today during her first interview since the disappearance. I can't come back and try to be something I am not, but I can't not come back because it's my family. She didn't anticipate faking her way through the show, which is normally lighthearted, with a mix of serious breaking news. There had been a great deal of speculation about whether she would return. "I want to smile, and when I do, it will be real," she told Hoda Kotb, who came back to Today to fill in while Guthrie focused on the search. "Being there is joyful, and when it's not, I'll say so." Nancy Guthrie made occasional appearances on Today over the years, once taking part in a cooking demonstration and surprising her daughter on the set. When Savannah Guthrie returned to her hometown of Tucson in 2025 for a segment recorded for the show, the two visited one of their favorite restaurants and talked about their love of Arizona. The Guthrie family has offered a $1 million reward for information leading to the recovery of their mother. Authorities believe Nancy Guthrie was kidnapped, abducted, or otherwise taken against her will after finding blood near the doorstep of her home in the foothills outside Tucson. The FBI later released surveillance videos showing a masked man on the porch that night. Volunteers and search teams scoured the nearby desert terrain filled with cactuses, bushes, and boulders in the first weeks after she vanished. But attention has faded from an investigation that was declared to be a top priority for the FBI and local authorities. Investigators have not released new evidence in weeks and say the number of tips has slowed. The FBI and the Pima County Sheriff's Department both said late last week they had no updates. Early on, some media outlets reported receiving ransom messages tied to the case. Guthrie said she and her siblings responded to two that they believed were real and offered to pay. Guthrie said her celebrity status might be the reason her mother was taken, but said that possibility was too much to bear. So that's the last article we'll cover. If you're a sports fan and you watch the NCAA basketball, you saw that Michigan won the national men's championship and UCLA won the women's national championship. A good weekend. So it's been a good hour reading to you. I thank you for listening to the stories I've read to you. I hope you've enjoyed them and found them interesting. I look forward to reading the news with you again in the near future. Until we have a chance to do that, I hope that life gives you many reasons to smile. Be well, my friends.